Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 16 of the Historic Performance Podcast. I'm your host, James Darley. After a really successful episode a couple of weeks back with Aiden Oakley talking about his time with rugby, I actually decided to veer off the realm of soccer this week and bring in a really well-known rugby coach. He's the founder of the website Rugby Strength Coach, none other than Keir Wenham Flatt. He was with the Argentina rugby union team during the Rugby World Cup, who ended up taking fourth place. But before we start talking a little bit more about the episode, I want to thank all of the listeners and some colleagues that sent questions to me via email to ask Keir. Keir was really indebted for it, and yeah, he couldn't believe some of the quality of the questions. In today's episode, we talk about a variety of things, including some of the essentials that Keir believes needs to be in a rugby strength program. He also talks about some of the differences in terms of gym-based S&C work between rugby league and rugby union. And we have a really comprehensive discussion about energy system development for rugby players. So if you really enjoy rugby, or even if you don't, it's a great episode. Let's get the show started. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Historic Performance Podcast. I'm really excited to be with a person that probably doesn't require a lot of introduction in the rugby world, Keir Wenham Flatt. And he's had quite a history. He's been on a ton of podcasts, but still really excited to have him. Keir, how are you?
I'm good. How you doing?
I'm doing really well, Keir, here in the States. So I have a ton of questions. Some of them are coming from some colleagues that I have here in the States that work with rugby and the university setting. So I'm excited to get to those questions for them.
Cool.
Beyond that, Keir, like I mentioned, you probably don't need a ton of introduction, but if you could just give just a brief history about yourself.
Okay, let me think. It started at around 14 when, you know, I always wanted to be a rugby player. And by the age of 15, I realized that I was way too slow, fat, white, untalented, not brave enough to be a professional rugby player. And I still didn't want to have a real job. So I decided that I want to be in the game at the highest level possible in whatever capacity I could be. And being quite academically minded and obviously I'd tried to train around genetics and my shortcomings as a player, I kind of fell into wanting to be a strength and conditioning coach. And my academic choices reflected that up until about the age of turning 19. And then I had a brief change of mind and decided to try and become a psychologist because I thought that it was more academically minded, loftier, all that kind of stuff. And obviously, when you've spent the previous 3-4 years just trying to train and be a better rugby player, it's not a logical step to go become a psychologist. So I dropped out of college the first time. And the next time that I went back, it was to study sports science. And I did a 3-year undergraduate at Leeds. Then I got slapped in the face by reality when I graduated, and I was completely unprepared to become a coach. Thankfully, though, around that time, I'd started a master's degree in strength and conditioning at the University of Bolton. And though, you know, academically it was a step backwards, it wasn't as challenging as the undergraduate had been. It was the ideal environment for me to be in as a coach, because it was actually forcing me to take what was in my head and try and get people in the real world to do the same kind of stuff. So I did that for 2 years. It was a 3-year part-time course. And eventually, after every time I failed, I would go away and work on the stuff that they said I wasn't good at. It got to the point where I was able to get an interview for a Premiership rugby club in London called London Wasps, who historically are one of the most successful English clubs. They've had a quite a difficult time in the last 5 years, coincidentally, after I started there. But yeah, I ended up getting a full-time internship to work for the academy there with a guy named Ian Taplin. So what I did was I deferred on the masters for a year, and I moved everything down to London. And I've been in rugby ever since. It was real difficult year doing the internship. I always tell people there are two types of interns, those who've considered quitting and those who are lying. When you're working 40 hours a week for no money, and it's a minimum of 40 hours a week, you know, no money, bottom of the food chain, getting no love, and you're not sure if you're going to get a job at the end of it. It's really, really difficult. But, you know, thankfully I did get a job at the end of it as the assistant the year after. And then the year after that, I became head of academy. And midway through that third season, I ended up moving to a lower league club, one league below, to be the head of strength and conditioning there, just because I wanted to boost my resume prior to going to Australia. At that point, I'd made the decision with my girlfriend at the time that we were going to move to Australia. I used to tell people, if I'm going to be poor, I'll be poor with a tan. And at the end of that season in 2013, we moved to Australia. And then through pure good fortune, right place, right time, right connections, Exos, who are an American company based out of Arizona, contacted me and said they needed a strength coach to replace their guy with Argentina on 2 days' notice. And would I be willing to be that guy to fill in? And it could have been for 1 week. It could have been for 12 weeks. And this is, 6 weeks after being in Australia, new house, new puppy, angry girlfriend. I actually dropped everything to go out to Argentina, and I ended up being there for 3 months. And off the back of that, I was asked to apply for the under-20s position at the Sydney Roosters, who, if you're familiar with rugby league, they're at the time the best rugby league club in the world, more money than Jesus, 10 minutes down the road. And, luckily I got that job. I was head of under-20s there. But due to some internal disciplinary issues above me, I got promoted to head of strength and conditioning after 3 weeks, which on paper was the best thing that ever happened to me, but in reality was the worst thing that's ever happened to me. I won't go too much into it because I can rant all day, but basically 6 months into that job, I decided it wasn't for me and I left. And I was very, very lucky to be allowed to return to Argentina, where I've been ever since. And that's culminated recently in us coming fourth in the World Cup, which was, if I'm completely honest, I thought that was our potential on our best day. We are top three, top four in the world. But it surprised a few people. So it's been really, really good for us in that I think people are taking us seriously as a rugby nation. And, it's great to be part of a team that's doing good things and winning. And obviously we've got a million different things that we can get better at. And I think there's a lot of potential for us to do even better in the future, especially with the fact that we've got Super Rugby this year.
Absolutely. So when you took over the Argentina job, did you speak Spanish at all?
Not a word. I was by no means the first foreign coach that they'd had. They'd had two other strength and conditioning coaches before me, who were English and Kiwi. They had a couple of other rugby coaches that were not from Argentina. And at the time that I was working there, Graham Henry was on the staff as well. So all of the guys speak English more or less. I'd say 90% of them speak English and speak it well. But I was of the opinion that it was culturally important that I learn Spanish, because when their guys come over here to Europe, they're expected to speak English or French or wherever they were, Italian. So as me being the foreigner going over there, I thought it was important to learn how to speak Spanish and to coach in Spanish, because that's the culture of the team. And I think it's been quite well received. Just from an organizational standpoint and a personal standpoint, occasionally in a team environment, I think you're going to have to be able to criticize one another. And I think if you're going to criticize somebody, it makes the criticism a lot easier to receive and to take in good faith when it's delivered to you in your own language rather than somebody else's.
No, absolutely. I totally agree with that. The podcast is going to be intermixed with some of my own questions and some of the questions that I have.
Cool.
I want to start off with one of the questions that I have. The question is, what are the essentials in terms of program design for rugby, at least for you?
Well, I think what many coaches get wrong, in my opinion, is assuming that if numbers in the gym go up, that the program works. And maybe this happens a little bit more in your neck of the woods than it does over here. But you'll talk about guys saying, we put this on a kid's squat, or we put this on a kid's, vertical jump, or you put this in a kid's bench, and they assume that the program works. But it's absolutely possible if you look at, the science from the stopwatch sports. I'm a real big fan of looking at stopwatch sports, because they're far easier to interpret if things work or don't work, because, you know, either you throw longer or you throw shorter, you run faster, you run slower. And if you look at things like the throws from Anatoly Bondarchuk's work, you can see that his guys' squats would go up, their snatch would go up, all their stuff would go up, but ultimately they weren't throwing further. And I think you can absolutely get that situation in rugby where you can have guys that are way, way stronger than another team, but they're not getting better on the field of play. So I think a big mistake that gets made, and I think a starting point that people need to start with as strength and conditioning coaches, is understand that everything that we do is there to enhance sporting skill, to enhance the intensity of it, the frequency of it, and the sustainability of it. And if your program doesn't do that, you can have all the gym numbers in the world, but your program doesn't work ultimately. I think that's a big thing. And I think, you know, kind of moving back from that and just speaking about physical preparation by itself, I think the biggest thing is speed of movement. Yes, it is true that strength benefits all other qualities, but the transfer of maximal strength to certain movements on the field of play, and I'd say the majority of movements on the field of play in rugby, that transfer ceases quite early. And basically after that, I think what maximal strength does is it allows you to be more stable. It allows you to get in certain positions more effectively. And then it just lays a foundation for the development of more specific abilities on top. So following on from that, I think it's really important that you establish what is a specific physical quality for your athletes, and what is a specific exercise that's going to give you transfer to the field of play for your athletes. And that's going to vary according to the strengths and weaknesses of the guys that you have, but also their training age, because how you train a kid or how you train an 18-year-old is very different to how you train a 35-year-old professional who's got, you know, over a decade of training under his belt.
That makes sense. And I also want to just transition to another question that I got from someone who emailed me. At what point do you feel that getting your rugby players stronger is actually time not well spent? And I think that's a good carryover from the previous one.
Yeah, I don't think it's a question of whether it's time well spent or not. I think the time can be very well spent, even if you're dealing with athletes where you don't have that direct transfer. You just have to understand what purpose it serves. So I think you can absolutely deal with guys who are, you know, let's say 30 years old. You know, you're not going to get that direct transfer, but, you know, for the reasons that I've said, strength is going to serve a purpose, and it's going to help lay that great foundation for you to build on where you will get the transfer. But I think maybe 20, 21, 22, maybe a little bit later for some of the really trainable guys. But I think beyond that age, if you look at what the professional players are doing, they're not getting much stronger after that age. And after that, really what you're doing is just maintaining that and then trying to direct your efforts towards development of physical abilities, which you feel are more specific to what they're doing. But I think what you need to do is look at what are your key performance indicators, or you think which are physical tests that most tax the physical abilities that underpin the position. And then if those continue to improve as maximal strength improves, then you can keep using it. But once you see that disconnect between maximal strength numbers and performance in your KPIs, then the chances are that you do need to switch to something that's more specific.
Next question that I have, and this is another email question, is there any differences in terms of rugby union or rugby league when it comes to designing a gym-based SNC program?
You know, when you are in the earliest stages of training, when guys are most sensitive to training, when transfer is highest, you're going to see the greatest amount of transfer from a general strength and conditioning program to specific outcomes on the field of play. So in the earlier stages of training, the answer would basically be a no. You're going to train all of the same stuff in a young rugby union athlete as you would in a young rugby league athlete. So you're going to be training linear speed, change of direction speed, power at various velocities, maximal strength, accessory movements, energy system development, and so on. And you're going to be looking to develop all of that movement literacy, which gives you the movement tools in the toolbox that allows you to respond to your environment in an optimal manner as a rugby player. But once you start to get towards the phases of the training career where specific training means become required, and you're going to see more and more difference between them. And I think there are certain positions in rugby league that are more similar to others in rugby union, but then certain ones in rugby union can be very specific and quite different to rugby league. I think there's a lot more uniformity in how you train rugby league players than you train rugby union. So we can, you know, looking at the example of rugby union, we can say what physical qualities does a prop forward need relative to a wing. And, you know, a prop forward is basically, they just need to be able to push as hard as possible at low speed. They need a huge amount of limit and isometric strength in lower body triple extension. Whereas, you know, a wing needs a ton of maximal velocity, which is going to be very, very high speed, very reactive, force production of the hamstrings and glutes with incomplete knee extension during maximal speed sprinting. So you can see that they're quite different, and you're going to train them with different specialized exercises. But I think that certain things you need to do in rugby league are fairly similar from position to position. I think everybody needs to be able to accelerate and accelerate through contact, and everybody needs to be able to kind of grapple and tackle. You know, rugby league is basically just running into people as hard as possible and then wrestling them to the ground. There will be some variation, and obviously some positions will do them more than others. I always think that, you know, your middle guys, your props, and your loose forward, they're going to be the guys carrying into contact and getting the most amount of resistance in sprinting compared to other positions. The guys in the wings and the edges are going to have the least amount of resistance, the most amount of build-up into contact if they do hit contact. And then there's going to be differences between all the positions. But whatever it is that you decide your guys need to do better than anyone else or do most frequently on the field of play, then you need to take a step backwards and say, well, what are the movement characteristics of those patterns? And what are the force characteristics of those patterns? And then can you develop exercises which heavily tax both of those at the same time? And then that is going to lead to the creation of your specialized exercises. And if you can measure performance in those exercises, I think those would create good KPIs for you to establish how prepared your athletes are for their position. And then from an energy system standpoint, if you look at the amount of running volume that gets covered, if you look at the rate of meters per minute between rugby league and rugby union, there's obviously a lot more running that gets done in league. And for that reason, I think you need a decent amount more of aerobic development. I would advocate aerobic alactic programming for, you know, nearly all rugby athletes. And I would lean more heavily towards the aerobic side of that for rugby league athletes, just because of the sheer volume of running, the intensity of running that they do. You know, it's not uncommon to get props getting, you know, 19s, 20s on the yo-yo test in National Rugby League in Australia, that's pretty high.
To take a break from some of these rapid fire questions that I'm saying with you in terms of the email, I actually want to ask one myself. I was reading the other day your blog post called My Training After Rugby World Cup. And yeah. I really appreciate that you put that out there. You mentioned Dr. Mike Zordos, who's an assistant professor at Florida Atlantic University. And he's done a couple studies looking at daily undulating gene periodization, or DUP, in powerlifters. And you mentioned that you've been trying to experiment with some of his DUP powering templates after your podcast conversation with Mike Hedletsky. So I was wondering, how have you been able to try to apply to athletes, and has it been successful at all, that experimentation?
I'm in terms of experimentation, I'm still in the guinea pig phase, where I'm doing it on myself before I really try it with the guys, because, you know, I think to be running a DUP program, you're going to have to do it in preseason, because realistically in a professional rugby league, you're only going to get two training days, Tuesday, Thursday. Monday's kind of a washout because it's a low intensity day. So your key training days are Tuesday, Thursday, and really you can't go that hard on Thursday. So in light of that, I want to make really, really, really sure that it works well before I expose the guys to it, because you don't want to use your entire preseason for a training program that you're not sure is going to work really, really well. But you know, what I've tried to do with it is informed by a few different conversations. I had a conversation with Mike, obviously, and one of the things that he said to me that really stood out in my mind, he said, if you look at, you know, the best squatters in the world, they squat as often as they can. If you look at the best benchers, they bench like bodybuilders. And if you look at the best deadlifters, they're basically just doing speed work. And that's pretty much it. So that stuck in my head. Him talking about Mike Zordos and DUP stuck in my head. I tried it just out the box with the program that he'd suggested. And I liked aspects of it. I didn't like aspects of it. When I say his program, I'm talking about the one that he published in his doctoral dissertation. What I didn't like about it was that, you know, the sets of eight in the compound stuff, it just really, really killed me. And it was kind of a self-selected load in that, which I wasn't hugely a fan of. I liked the strength stuff, but again, that was to failure. And I thought, you know, do I really need to be going to failure to develop strength stuff with this? I know from myself, I know from my guys that we can get significantly stronger without going to failure. And with fatigue management being so important in rugby, I thought, well, you know, I'm going to change that. And then with regard to the power stuff, you know, five sets of one at 80% didn't really feel to me like the kind of power that we would want to be developing with our guys. So I kept the idea of doing all those big lifts three times a week. I'm squatting three times a week. Sorry, squatting twice a week, deadlifting once a week, and benching three times a week. And then what I tried to incorporate into that was triphasic training from a guy that I know called Cal Dietz. He's written a really, really good book, which I reckon, you know, everyone should check out. And what I liked about that was that the triphasic training, I think, reflects more accurately the reality of what we're having to do as athletes. So when you're just doing a straight out of the box powerlifting program, whether you do it slowly, whether you do it quickly, whether you do it with good eccentric control or bad eccentric control, no one really cares as long as you get the weight up. And we know that athletic movement is not that simple. When you're training athletes, you have to think about what's the quality of the eccentric, what's the amortization phase, how quick is the concentric, because answering those questions is going to tell you about how athletic that movement's going to be. I really, really like the principles that underpin it, so I tried to incorporate that into the program. So if you read Cal's book, he recommends doing targeted mesocycles where you'll do, for example, a block of eccentric focus training, a block of isos, and then a block of concentric focus training. And that works good. But you know, it can be quite logistically difficult to fit into the real world. You know, what do you do if you don't have an even number of weeks? Suddenly you have to start trimming some blocks shorter than others. So I took an idea from a friend of mine named Sam Portland, who I work with at London Wasps, and used his template, which is to actually train all three within the week. So you do one day of eccentric, one day of isometric, one day of concentric. So then I started to incorporate that into the model that I'd adapted from Mike. So on a Tuesday, I'm doing eccentric focus back squat and eccentric focus bench. On a Thursday, I'm doing pause front squat and pause bench, which I did today. And then on a Saturday, I'm just doing straight deadlift, straight bench. And then in terms of the accessory stuff, this is where Mike Zordos doesn't include stuff. And I can understand why he doesn't include it, because he's generating a lot of fatigue with his primary exercises, the percentages and the volumes that he used. However, I've modified it a little bit with Prolepin's table. I've avoided failure. I've got a bit more in the tank to do accessory work. So I'm just doing accessory work to support the squat on a Tuesday, the bench on a Thursday, and the deadlift on a Saturday. So my two biggest training days are the Tuesday, Thursday, and then, sorry, the Tuesday, Saturday. And then that Thursday in the middle just gives me, again, a higher intensity training day, but allows me a little bit of a drop in intensity, a little bit less lower body focused, which allows me to recover a little bit more ready for the deadlifts on Saturday. And the only other elements that I think off the top of my head, yeah, so power stuff, really just maintenance at the moment. I'm not playing at the moment just because of work and where I am. So power is not hugely important for me, even though I beat my guys over the head and say power, not strength, power, not strength. But I'm doing a little bit of extensive plyometrics, just stolen from Verkashansky. And then I'm doing some ballistics as well to support each of the main lifts. So I'll do a jump squat on the Tuesday. I'll do a bench throw on the Thursday. and I'm doing some power cleans on the Saturday just to keep myself fresh in terms of doing the Olympic lifts, even though we don't use them. I just keep doing them to make sure that haters say I can't do them. And that's basically it.
Since you mentioned the Olympic lifts, I know you've written a blog post on this, and I know where you stand on it. But just for some of the audience that may not know, what are your thoughts in terms of using the Olympic lifts in a team environment, and kind of the benefits or downfalls of it?
Okay, in a word, it's stupid, but I will give you the long version. Okay, so in terms of transfer of training, we've said that the earlier you are in your training career, the more transfer you will see from a general exercise to a specific outcome on the field of play. The older and older and older and more experienced you get as a trainee, the more intensity, the more specificity, and the less variety you need to utilize in your training to get that transfer. Now, you can argue a little bit about what is specific to each position on the field of play, but I don't think many people are going to argue with you that we are a running-based sport. So everything that we do has to be framed in terms of how specific an exercise is relative to the sprinting action. And the criteria which makes an exercise more or less specific, as outlined by Yuri Vukashansky, is direction and magnitude of force production, range of movement, and where in that range that you produce the maximal force, movement velocity, contact time, how much muscular stretch there is, and off the top of my head, muscles used. So if you look at, for example, top-end sprinting, you can say, well, the range of movement is actually quite small during force production in contact with the floor. It's a little bit of hip extension. I think it's like 15 degrees. How much muscular stretch is there? Absolutely tons compared to any gym program with any exercise. How much contact time is there? A tenth of a second or less. Some people get down to like 0.09. Muscles used, hamstrings and glutes, joint actions, hip extension, incomplete ankle extension, isometric plantar flexion. Movement velocity is the highest that our lower body is capable of. It's nowhere close to anything in the gym. Gym movements, even the Olympic lifts, are way, 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 way slower. And that's basically the characteristics of top-end sprinting. So when you compare an Olympic lift, let's say a power clean, what's the range of movement? Well, it's different. Where within the peak force is the range of movement? It's fairly similar. How much contact time you have available? Compared to sprinting, you have an age. What's the movement speed? Way, way, way slower. What's the joint action? Triple extension, so it's different. Where's the direction of force? It's vertical versus horizontal. How much muscular stretch is there? There's some, but there's not a lot compared to sprinting, and so on. So in terms of how specific they are, you can agree just by looking at those facts that the Olympic lifts are not that specific when you compare it to something like a hurdle bound or a plyometric bound, for example, or a resisted or assisted sprint. So the less specific something becomes, the more general it becomes in classification. And the thing about general things is they're interchangeable. You don't have to be specific. You can be general. So if an exercise is general, it's interchangeable with anything else that achieves the same outcome, in my opinion. And when we're talking about what the Olympic lifts give you, they're basically giving you triple extension against resistance within a certain velocity, which is normally about 0.5 to 0.8 meters per second of mean velocity. Now, some people argue that they teach you to go from rapid extension to rapid flexion. I would argue that's not the case with most team sport athletes who just turn it into a reverse curl sumo squat. They would also argue that, you know, they teach athletes how to decelerate. And my response to that is, if you have athletes who have problems decelerating on 2 feet vertically, you've got serious problems. And that normally when they're getting hurt, it's because they're decelerating on one leg in the frontal or transverse plane, which the Olympic lifts don't teach. So I think they're a general exercise, and all they teach you is triple extension without inherent deceleration. So I can name you a few other exercises right now that teach you that. So for example, trap bar jump, you know, clean pull if you wanted to do that, jump squat, anything like that. The difference is that those exercises teach 30 seconds to teach, and an Olympic lift takes you 6 weeks with a broomstick. And if you're talking 6 weeks with a broomstick just to get somebody to do, you know, a body weight clean, you've just wasted 6 weeks. And for a professional rugby team, that's your entire preseason. So nobody is judging a coach on how pretty your Olympic lifts are or how much somebody cleans. They're judging you on how fast do they sprint, how hard do they hit, how high do they jump. And to do that, you need a training effect. You don't need to get the guys to do cleans with a broomstick or snatches with a broomstick. So to me, it seems to be a rather inefficient use of training time. People are welcome to use them with their athletes, but I think everything that we do as coaches is cost versus benefit. How much is it going to cost you in terms of time, attention, all of those things within the program versus how much you get out of it? And I think we have guys within our system that have been with us that long now that they have never, ever, ever done an Olympic lift. And yet, you know, they're running around people, they're knocking people over on the field of play that are doing Olympic lifts all their career. And I think that illustrates quite nicely that if there is a difference, it's certainly not apparent with us. And, you know, it's not making a difference for us. We're just as fast, we're just as powerful, and we're just as strong as other teams. And hopefully we have a lot more time available on our hands to practice the stuff that really affects physical performance, in my opinion, which is being able to sprint and change direction and decelerate and play the sport.
I'm really glad you brought up the point about cost-benefit analysis because there's a lot of young coaches here, and I think that's something that you always need to look at. You always need to look at, you know, what benefits am I gaining from this and what is it costing me? And that's something that sometimes as strength and conditioning coaches, we forget to do, especially like early on in our career. So I'm really glad you highlighted that.
Yeah, I think it becomes more and more and more apparent the higher up you go, because the competition schedule gets more and more packed. You know, like this year we had 3 weeks to get ready for the Rugby Championship to play New Zealand. And then after the Rugby Championship, we had a total of 4 weeks in three different countries. And that's, you know, logistically, that's a nightmare. So you really have to be getting the maximum bang for your buck. And the Olympic lifts are not that.
I'm just grabbing my list. I want to make sure that I get all these email questions. So there's actually just one more, but this one's probably going to be quite lengthy.
Cool.
And it's about energy system development in rugby. He said, Kier, what focuses do you have during different phases, off-season, pre-season, in-season, when it comes to energy system development?
Okay, so you kind of have to start at the beginning and work your way backwards. What's the goal of an energy system program for rugby athletes or any field sport athlete? And that is to have the greatest intensity of high-intensity efforts repeated for the greatest possible frequency and sustainability for the duration of the game. And I can go into more scientific reasons for this, and I do that on the community website that I've got at the moment with various like webinars outlining what we do. But basically, if you look at the three energy systems, the alactic system is the most powerful, the most intense, and the aerobic system is the most frequent and repeatable. The glycolytic system is neither of those things, and basically fatigue is a decision by the central nervous system to protect itself from future damage. And it uses a mixture of internal, external feedback to make a decision about how sustainable exercise is. And from an internal perspective, it's basically using the physiological state to infer how damaging exercise is going to be. And the majority of the physiological variables which trigger that fatigue decision are byproducts of relying heavily on the glycolytic system. So for those reasons, we try and emphasize the alactic and the aerobic systems and teach our athletes to become less reliant on the glycolytic system. So rather than trying to teach them how to suffer better or suffer for longer, we would rather try and teach them how not to suffer in the first place. And I don't really buy into the arguments that you can condition somebody to be tough, or if you just get mentally tough enough athletes, you can make them fit without really trying to be specific or logical in how you condition them. And that's because, you know, pussies are always pussies. You can't turn a pussy into a champion, no matter how much you MF them and do hard work. And the physiological state is far more trainable than the plasticity of the central nervous system to tolerate fatigue. It is a factor, and you know, the glycolytic system will get used in rugby games, but we would on the side of letting rugby practice take care of it for us, and just putting aside a couple of weeks at the very, very end of preparation to to get that done. The rest of the time, we're trying to manipulate the physiological capacity of the athlete to rely less on that glycolytic system and to reduce those feedback signals going to the brain, which is going to lead to fatigue. And if we just look at what we've described as the eventual goal of an energy system program, basically we've described repeat sprint ability or repeated high intensity efforts. Working backwards from that, what do you need to do that? Well, you need a good amount of alactic capacity. So the ability to be able to sustain or repeat high intensity efforts via the alactic system. And you need higher intensity aerobic adaptations. And then you go back a stage and say, well, what underpins that? And from the alactic system, the answer is alactic power, because power without capacity just means that if you take somebody who's shit and you give them capacity, they're just shit for longer. So you have to be powerful first before you can extend that into capacity. From the aerobic system, there are low level adaptations which support that. And then working backwards a step further, in order to train alactic power, generally you're talking about maximal intensity training, like maximal speed, strength and power, wrestling and so on. You need to earn the right to do that. You need to mitigate for injury risk factors. You need to develop work capacity. You need to develop technical mastery so that when you do perform that maximal training, you're not paying too high a cost and you're not exposing your athletes to an excessively high level of injury risk. And in terms of the aerobic system, you know, I've mentioned high, low, and very low intensity adaptations. Basically, what we're doing with that is selecting various aerobic adaptations within the chain of events from taking oxygen from the outside environment and putting them into the cell for use within the electron transport chain. And we've scheduled them in order of which has the longest physiological variable. So, a residual. And a residual is basically how long can the body hold on to an adaptation before it loses it. So the ones that we hold on to longest, we put at the beginning, then the medium term, then the shorter term, and then the shortest term. And then basically it's like trying to spin plates. You train the variables in block one, and then you hold on to them for a longer time. Then you switch focus to phase two, and then you hold on to them a little bit less. Phase three, a little bit less. Phase four, a little bit less. And at the end of phase four, or in phase four for us, that's when we're in competition. That's our desired kind of peak. So that would give you some insight into what we're doing in the preparation, and then in our phase four, our in competition, basically what we're doing is trying to retain all of the physiological adaptation from the previous phases of training via rugby training and rugby matches. And rather than looking to develop physiological abilities, what we're trying to do is reduce fatigue, to realize adaptation, and to develop various movement strategies which allow our athletes to use the adaptation that they have in the most efficient manner possible, and to basically desensitize the central nervous system to fatigue and get them used to working hard. But you know, you can't do that all year round if you're in a domestic league situation. So you're in season, I think you're going to have to try and select weeks within your schedule where you can afford to expose your guys to a little bit more fatigue than normal, and try and re-stimulate or retain or just give a little bit of a boost to abilities which you have trained in the preparation, and schedule those in a logical manner. And then when you do come to those key games or key periods throughout the season that you want to peak for, that's when you would be using that kind of realization environment for your energy system stuff, rather than concentrating on development. Because, you know, for me, there's a big difference between training to develop an ability and training to express or realize an ability.
Kier, to finish some of these questions off, because that was the last large question, I have some really small ones. I just wanted to do a bit of a lightning round. So it's going to be a yes, no, and maybe a 30-second response.
Cool.
First one, Nordic hamstring curls effective for preventing hamstring pulls?
No more effective than anything else. Look at the biomechanic characteristics of a hamstring pull, range of movement, contact time, movement velocity, degree of muscular stretch. Then look at the biomechanical characteristics of a Nordic curl, and they are just a different planet. So being able to do Nordics is no guarantee that you're going to be injury free if you don't have athletes that sprint well and that have developed good capacity to produce and tolerate force within the hamstrings in the sprinting action, and that you're in a program where the load is appropriately managed. If you can't answer those questions as well, all the Nordics in the world won't help you, and our guys don't do them.
Next one, neck isometrics helpful for concussion prevention?
The jury's out, but it's certainly helpful for the prevention of neck injuries and also for maintaining good head position in contact. Real important that you do them in all three planes of movement, though.
If you have a poor runner, does it help to work on running mechanics for rugby?
It doesn't matter who you are. It helps to run on. It helps to work on running mechanics. And the reason for that is, you know, if you, let's say you have a Fiat 500, so like you got a little shit car with a crappy engine. If the wheels are out of alignment and you go around the track pretty fast as you can in that car, you're going to incur some damage. But now if you imagine that those wheels are out of alignment and you've got a Formula One car, how much faster are you going to break that car? The answer is like incredibly fast. The faster and faster and faster you become and the stronger and more powerful you become, the higher a price you're going to pay for poor joint positioning and poor movement patterning. So really, before any force capacity is added to the athlete, you should be trying to remove those mechanical inefficiencies. And mechanical efficiency is a great thing to pursue for its own sake, because you're going to increase your ability to apply force within a certain movement pattern without even getting stronger. And when you're in an environment where you're trying to get the maximum adaptation for the least amount of training stress and training time, that is, you know, the goal, and that's what movement training is going to give you. And not only that, but when you increase efficiency, you're going to decrease energy cost at a given power output, and that makes sporting skill more frequent and more repeatable. And obviously, putting yourself into those safe joint positions is going to reduce injury risk factors. And you can't say that you're going to get all three of those from other training tools like resistance training or energy system development. So it absolutely needs to be the priority of any strength and conditioning program, in my opinion.
Kier, I like to always finish off my podcast because I know I have a lot of young strength and conditioning coaches that are either have done a couple of internships and they're currently in university or just graduated from university. What recommendations would you have for them? I know you mentioned hard work, expect to work long hours, but do you have anything else?
Well, I mean, if they want to go into detail, there's a seminar on my website that I put up, which I did as a paid seminar in Christmas 2014. It's called How to Get a Job in Strength and Conditioning. So if you go on rugbystrengthcoach.com, you'll see a banner for it. You can click on that and you can get that for free. But the short answer is basically when you are trying to build a career as a strength and conditioning coach, you have to be a salesman. You have to learn how to sell yourself. And just as much as you learn how to sell yourself, you also have to work on the product that you're selling. And like anything that anyone buys, you have to be scarce, you have to be remarkable, you have to be, you know, the most dot dot dot, whatever that is. You cannot just be what everyone else is, because when there's a million of everything that looks exactly the same, people aren't going to stick their hand in their wallet and pay a lot for it. So I think you need to concentrate really well on building relationships. That helps to sell, and building a niche within the team that you work in, and bringing some experience and skills and knowledge to the table that not every other applicant or every other intern is going to have. Because, you know, the truth is I could go out and find you 100 interns tomorrow that have a degree, that have, you know, CSCS, that have done an internship, that know how to get kit out and get kit in. But the truth is that they are not scarce and they're not going to really add anything new to a program. And for that reason, they're probably not going to get a job. Whereas if you've got guys that when they've done all the normal intern jobs, then they're on the floor coaching, they're building relationships with their athletes. They're looking at where are the problems within the existing program. They're speaking to the head coach or the athletic director about what are his problems? What does he want to build for the future? And then they're working on making that stuff into a reality, and they're making themselves indispensable to the program because they're doing stuff that only they can do. I think that's when they're far more likely to get hired and get a job at the end of it.
Yeah, I really think that's a great recommendation. That's a recommendation that I would give as well, just from internships that I've done, to make sure that you make yourself indispensable, to make sure that you, without gain on anyone's toes, making sure that you're out there, you're one of the hardest working, and you're always continuing to become a better strength coach, would be my little tidbit.
Yeah, like I tell people, you know, you have to be a house elf first, And only then, only when you finish all of the other jobs, when all the other interns go home, that's when the internship begins.
Kier, it was amazing having you on. If anyone has questions, comments, how can they contact you? Via your website?
Yeah, if you just Google Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Rugby Strength Coach, or rugbystrengthcoach.com, you can contact me through any of those channels.
Cool. I'm going to post it on my website when I publish this podcast. That way they can easily reach out to you. I'm sure there's going to be some questions. So Kier, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. It was tons of useful information here. I really appreciate it, man.
My pleasure, James. Thank you for having me, mate.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Historic Performance Podcast. I hope you really enjoyed this one with Kier. I thought it was a great episode, very informative on my end. If you have any questions or comments for him, go to www.historicperformance.net. That's where I publish all my podcast episodes, and his information and his website is going to be there. That way you can easily contact him. If you've been enjoying the podcast episodes, any of the previous ones, please make sure to follow me via Twitter at Historic Perform. That's where I tweet out all of the new episodes. So with that said, I'll see you guys next time.